And now it's time to look towards our wonderful series, which is particularly apt today as we look to the spirit of Anzac, Richard, because our wonderful friend who's going to give us our On the Veranda story, Roger Underwood AM. He's a storyteller, a retired forester and bushfire fighter. And the story he's going to give us today, I think, will appeal to us all, but to you, Richard, because it links boyhood.
Eon Idris and the Desert Column. Chatting with old friends over a beer one day, the subject of best remembered books of our youth came up. It came as no surprise that of six participants in the discussion, all aged in our 70s or beyond, there was unanimity. The best remembered book was The Desert Column by Eon Idris, subtitled Leaves from the Diary of an Australian Trooper in Gallipoli, Sinai and Palestine. I read The Desert Column when I was about 15 or 16, and I can still remember being enthralled by it. The discussions amongst friends about The Desert Column intrigued me, so I acquired a copy from the library. Again, I read it enthralled, staying up late on cold winter nights to finish it off, following up references about the desert campaign in the Middle East during World War I. Given events in this region as I write, it is also strangely evocative. The same names and places that were battle zones in 1917 and 1918 keep cropping up in today's news reports and commentary. Idris was a trooper in the Australian Light Horse. His book, The Desert Column, started life as a diary kept by Idris all through the war and was first published in 1932 and then, remarkably, was reprinted again and again up to 1951. Rereading the book today, it is not hard to see why, as it combines so many fascinating elements: history, war, mateship, horses, bushmanship, hardship, disaster, triumph. It is also well written in the simple language of the outback and of the bush poet.
I began the diary as we crowded the decks off Gallipoli and watched the first shells crash into Turkish soil. Gradually, it grew to be a mania. I would whip out the little book and note immediately anything exciting that was happening. As the years dragged on, my haversack became full of little notebooks. These memories are my sole souvenirs of the war. Except, of course, stray bits of shrapnel, bomb, and high explosive splinters, which nearly every soldier collected.
The diary commences on May the 18th, 1915, off Cape Helles in the Dardanelles. The Australian Light Horse was dismounted and sent to Gallipoli to fight as infantry to support the troops who had landed a few weeks before. They found themselves in an appalling debacle from the outset. Through those early chapters, Idris does not spare the reader. He writes with controlled emotion, almost matter-of-factly, but the impact is blood-chilling. The Australians were repeatedly asked to do the impossible, to charge over open ground against entrenched defenders armed with machine guns and occupying the heights. All these years later, I could smell the cordite fumes and the reek of the dead, hear the cries and the clamour, feel the percussion of shells and the whistle of snipers' bullets, and sense the exhaustion, the relentless danger, the stress, and the constant loss of good mates cut down on all sides. Whole regiments were decimated. Yet all of this is interspersed with unexpected moments of peace and beauty. For example, Idris writes in one place,
"Tonight is the first night we've had no shrapnel. We are sitting by a dugout on the hillside, little groups singing, others smoking, others delousing themselves. The colonel's gramophone is playing the Marseillaise, and the rest of us are silently watching a beautiful, peaceful scene. The sun is sinking, a golden ball behind the island of Imbros. Over a sea of deepest blue, destroyers are quietly gliding. Behind us, the hills are darkening, and the Aegean is peaceful. And one star is in the sky.
The facilities for treating the wounded were totally inadequate, as was the water supply, the nutrition, and the sanitary arrangements. After the first battle lines had deteriorated into stalemate, both Australians and Turks were eating, breathing, sleeping and fighting amongst decomposing bodies. Little wonder that septicemia was rife. Indeed, this is what threatened to end Idris's Gallipoli campaign. A scratch from a shell splinter to his knee was left untreated, became infected, there were of course no antibiotics in those days, and rendered him virtually a cripple. Eventually he was stretchered off to a naval vessel and to the government hospital in Alexandria. As was always the case in the First War, the moment he could walk again, Idris was declared fit and posted back to Gallipoli. Here the situation for the Anzacs had deteriorated further, with the Turkish defence well entrenched and now advised by German generals and supported by German artillery. Before long, Idris was even more seriously wounded when he was blown up by a bomb that landed directly in his trench. At that stage, the Australian and Turkish trenches were only a few metres apart, and grenades were being lobbed across by both parties with terrible results. Again, Idris survived. Again, he was stretchered out and spent many weeks in the hospital and convalescing in Alexandria. His release from hospital after recovery from his latest wounds coincided pretty much with the withdrawal of the Allied forces from Gallipoli. The infantry was sent to France, but the light horse brigades were reformed and retained in the Middle East to continue the fight against Turkey. The light horse was not cavalry, but mounted infantry. Light horsemen were armed with rifle and bayonet, not sabres, and they were organised for rapid deployment at a moment's notice. The traditional cavalry charge was not their normal mode of operation at all. Rather, they would move swiftly by horseback, travelling in columns, to a defensive or offensive position, and then dismount. Each troop was made up of units of four men who operated as a team within a team. One was designated the horseholder, his job being to take the reins of the other three horses and retreat to a safe place until the order came for the foot soldiers to advance or retreat. Meanwhile, the other three acted as riflemen infantry. The Australian light horsemen prided themselves on four things: their horsemanship, marksmanship, mateship, and bushmanship. They travelled fast and light, sleeping under a blanket on the ground in the open rather than in tents, scrounging for food and firewood. They were masters of survival under tough conditions. In the desert, their operations were continuously focused on finding, attacking, or defending oases and wells. It was a war over water as much over territory. Their horses were Australian station and stock horses, known as Whalers because they came originally from New South Wales. They were renowned for speed, strength and endurance, and could accelerate from a standstill to a gallop in one forward bound. The Whalers were trained to be indifferent to gunfire, to lie down on command, and to travel silently at night. They could go, and often did, 2 or 3 days without a drink, and were considered by the light horsemen as vastly superior in desert warfare to the camels used by the Anzac Camel Corps. Having recovered from the wounds received at Gallipoli, Idris rejoined the 5th Light Horse as a mounted trooper and was soon involved in the defence of the Suez Canal. The capture of the canal was the Turks' main objective at that time, as it would have completely disrupted the British war effort. The light horse task at this point was mostly scouting. They would move out from the main camp at night and travel silently far into the desert. Here they would set up observation points, which they would occupy for a few days, and from which they could monitor and report on enemy troop movements. Idris records in his diary,
"There are 12 of us up here on the peak of the world. Four are down the hill in a sheltered spur by the horses. Stretching before us is a sea of sand peaks. If the Turks come, our job is to detect them miles away."
Here we also meet Idris's mates, Stan, Bert and Big Morrie. The four of them are an inseparable unit for the rest of the war, riding and fighting side by side, sharing packages from home, boiling their quart pots over a shared fire, and keeping up with each other's spirits with laughter and yarns. The bond between the men and their horses is never sentimentalized, but it is a theme that emerges over and over again throughout the Desert Column. It is fascinating to see how the discipline of the soldier is also expected of the horses. Here is Idris on a standing patrol at night, 2 miles out in the desert.
"During my watch, I was holding the 7 horses. They were very sleepy, standing so still. One old bay's eyes slowly closed. His head sagged, his knees bent, and if I had not jerked the reins, he would have lain down. A pretty little brown horse stared imploringly with big black eyes that slowly closed in the moonlight. But I would not let him lie down. All my mates lay huddled asleep on the sand, except Big Morrie, a veritable giant in his great coat, standing clear in the moonlight like a sphinx, gazing out into the desert. The desert dogs came creeping close and howled."
A modern reader feels almost disbelief at the way in which these fighting men were fed. The standard meal, 3 times a day, was steel-hard biscuit and tinned bully beef, washed down with black tea and accompanied by a cigarette or a smoke of the pipe. They had no fruit or vegetables, except on the rare occasions they were able to gather dates from an oasis. And their only fresh meat and milk was obtained from goats captured now and again from the Bedouin. For months,
"We did not change our clothes. We have lived in them, slept in them, always ready for instant action."
All the troopers were driven mad by lice, and most of them suffered septic sores and ill health resulting from the inadequate and monotonous diet. Occasionally, they would receive a food parcel from home with treasures like a tin of golden syrup or fruit jam. It seems a miracle to me that they did not all come down with scurvy. Many parts of the Desert Column are fascinating from a non-military viewpoint. Idris and his colleagues are fighting in an ancient land and often find themselves digging out an old Roman well and marvelling at its workmanship, or encountering the remains of a temple dating from biblical times. As was the case with his Gallipoli diaries, Idris does not spare the reader with his accounts of battle, especially when the light horsemen are defending a position against advancing Turkish infantry or involved in hand-to-hand fighting when overrunning an enemy position. The Turkish defenders are trampled by maddened horses, bayoneted, shot or bombed, and the carnage is terrible. The Turks, according to Idris, were wonderful riflemen and brave attackers, but could not confront berserker Australians at work with the bayonet and driven to revenge the cruel slaughter of the light horse at Gallipoli. A feature of the book is that it captures a watershed in military history when age-old and modern technologies overlapped. Horsemen defend the Suez Canal. Camel-mounted infantry oppose armoured cars. Riflemen shoot at aircraft. The first tanks and armoured trains appear. Cavalry men armed with sabres attack troops armed with machine guns. Communication is by heliograph, but the first field telephones are in use. Food comes in tins, but water supplies are drawn from wells and cisterns built in Roman times. The book's culmination is the description of the famous charge of the Australian Light Horse at Beersheba, in which Idris did not participate, but which he watched through field glasses from an observation post.
"Forward we'll take Beersheba, spur up and on, light horse and ride.
Turkish guns blazed at those hazy horsemen, but they came steadily on. At 2 miles distant, they emerged from clouds of dust, squadrons of men and horses taking shape. At a mile distant, their 1,000 hooves were stuttering thunder, coming at a rate that frightened a man. Oh, they were an awe-inspiring sight, galloping through the red haze, knee to knee and horse to horse, the dying sun glinting on bayonet points.
Half a mile to the rise, we'll take the Turks by surprise. Keep the trot, hold the line, as we wait for the sign. Clear the brow of the hill, keep it steady until we're in range of the guns, then we'll break into a run.
The rout of Beersheba by the Australian Light Horse was a turning point in the desert campaign, opening up a gap in the Turkish defence, allowing the capture of Gaza. By March 1918, the end was in sight, and in October, the Turkish army capitulated. But well before the end, Idris's war was over. Resting with a fever at a Red Cross camp, shelling from Turkish artillery left him with shrapnel wounds to an arm and a leg. An appalling journey by cart, motor ambulance and train eventually brought him to the Australian Infantry Hospital in Cairo. Here his diary concludes.
January 2nd, 1918. I am to be returned to Australia as unfit for further service. Thank heaven.
Heartfelt though this is, I was more touched by an observation made earlier in the book, one which I think sums up the universal philosophy of the Australian Light Horseman.
But the dearest memory, the memory that will linger until I die, is the comradeship of my mates. These thousands of men who laugh so harshly at their own hardships and sufferings, but whose smile is so tenderly sympathetic to others in pain.
Eon Idris, always known as Jack to his mates, died in 1979, aged 90, a revered Australian author. In my youth, there would hardly have been an Australian home without at least one of his books on the shelf.
And we